final case of the morning is Malik v. Falcon Holdings. Ms. Ross.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Plaintiffs' appellants are former high-level employees of Falcon Holdings seek a reversal and reinstatement of their breach of contract and fraud claims in this commercial dispute for three reasons. First, because they presented sufficient evidence of damages along with a reasonable basis for computing them. Second, because regardless of the evidence of damages, plaintiffs sought a constructive trust remedy which would make them defendants constructive trustees of the equity ownership, excuse me. And third, because the defendants' arguments to the contrary are not well-founded. The district court ruled that the record does not support the inference that Falcon's value was equal to the price that Kahn paid on two basic grounds, because Kahn bought only Sentinel and Omega's interest, not the entire company, and because what he paid was based on the amount of financing he could get, which the district court concluded was not necessarily the value of the company.
Well, I'm willing to accept your argument, counsel, that if either of those is a problem, it suggests that the value put on the company is too low, which actually favors your client rather than the defense. I'm worried about some other problems in this case. As you described the promise was to provide these 20 senior employees with 50% of the equity. But the transaction you described, the usual phrase for that, is a leveraged buyout. Right? The third-party financier was bought out in a leveraged transaction that left Falcon highly, mostly debt. You provided a value of the company as a whole, but not an estimate of how much of that value was now debt and how much was equity, and therefore not an estimate of the value of 50% of the equity. At least that's what it looks like. Now, isn't that a problem?
Your Honor, we don't think it is. We think that because the jury can look at the value...
No. This is not something you give to a jury without expert evidence, right? You get a financial economist who submits an affidavit saying, I've calculated this and I can figure it out, maybe. But did you do anything like that? Is there any evidence from which the jury would base a conclusion on anything other than intuition?
There certainly is not expert testimony, nor was there expert testimony presented
okay.
at the
so
motion.
Okay, so we're back to my question. Isn't that a problem? What you need to know, if you need to know what is the value of 50% of the equity, you'd have to know how much some third party in an arm's-length transaction would pay for 100% of the equity. Now, you can divide that by two. But all we've got is what a third party would pay for the whole firm en blanc, assuming it had no debt.
Well, Your Honor, we do have that implied purchase price. We also have McCormick's testimony that the implied purchase price was the product of a negotiated transaction.
Now, maybe I'm just not being clear. Let's assume that some outside holder, right? Let's assume that the original financier, Sentinel, owned 100% of Falcon, right? And that an insider, Kahn, buys the firm from Falcon and pays them $50 million in cash, right? That tells us that the value of Falcon is $50 million. And in order to do this transaction, Falcon borrows $40 million. Right? So Sentinel is paid $50 million in cash. Falcon now has $40 million in debt. What is the value of Kahn's holdings in Falcon? Now, the normal answer would be $10 million or something in that range. What you seem to be saying is that its value is $50 million, which is wrong. Now, I may be completely completely wrong in thinking that the amount borrowed in order to do this transaction was $40 million, maybe some different number. It may be that the equity would be valued at a different number because that's what it would sell for to somebody who's interested in buying LBO proceeds. But has there been any effort on this record to quantify this?
I think the answer to that is no. The record doesn't have that kind of analysis.
When Sentinel was taken out, how much money did Falcon borrow?
When Sentinel was taken out, that answer is not in the record, Your Honor.
It seems to me absolutely essential to know that answer in order to get anything remotely looking like an estimate of the value of 50% of the equity.
Your Honor, I think the cases that look at value from Illinois as well as from this court have said that in order to avoid summary judgment, a litigant needs to show damages and be prepared to show some reasonable amount. In this case, there are a number of facts in the record that show that the plaintiff suffered damages if their theory is accepted after a trial. There is testimony in the record that the real estate alone was worth $26 to $27 million. There is testimony in the record of the enterprise value of the company based on a negotiated transaction. And in fact, and I apologize for not supplying this decision earlier, but in the letter brief that I filed yesterday, there's an Illinois case that accepts the purchase price as being a proper way to value a company, even though it's 21 months later, and then goes on to say, but we needed testimony about the how the company did in that interim period. In this case, the value would be on the same date as the transaction occurred. And from that case, it seems to me that's enough to avoid summary judgment. In discussing it, McCormick explained that the implied purchase price looked at the debt that's on the business immediately before the sale, and that's in his deposition at record 58, plus the value of preferred securities, plus the gross debt value of the common units. And so that suggests, again, a way of approaching damages that we believe is sufficient to go to the jury.
You're not arguing, I take it, that it was appropriate to conduct more discovery or that you had some evidence to offer that is not already in the record?
We have not made that argument, no, Your Honor. The motion came at the end of discovery. It does seem to me that some of the testimony that was presented in the record through the witnesses who would be speaking at trial would certainly elaborate on some of these points, and that would be expected. You have McCormick, who would be testifying at trial, and you have the various parties. So the question about the precise amount of debt that McCormick mentions and how it related to the enterprise value purchase price would certainly be able to be elaborated on, but I'm not suggesting anything beyond that. I see that the light is on, so maybe I will save the remainder of
them. Well, I'm going to interfere with that because I've got another question. But my other kind of question is, according to the record, how much were plaintiffs going to pay for their stock? The normal way in which senior managers are given incentives is through stock options, or here, the equivalent in an LLC. And it's done that way in part to tie them up to the firm for a period of years so they don't just get the stock and leave and cash it out immediately, and in part because actually just handing them shares of stock is a tax calamity because it's immediate ordinary income, and at that point the senior manager has no alternative but to sell half of it in order to pay the income taxes, which in a closely held corporation won't work, right? The alternative is to do this by the option route, but then you need such things as what's the strike price on the option? How long does the option last? I mean, according to this record, were there any of those, what seem to me, vital details?
This record does not contain those details, Your Honor, but I think that is not a defect in the argument we're advancing here with respect to summary judgment. The fact that this transaction and the promise that was made to the plaintiffs was not as complicated sophisticated a promise as may be the ordinary course in that kind of transaction.
Well, look, you see, my problem is the promise, as the plaintiffs describe it, is business insanity. You would never make the offer that the simple offer the plaintiffs describe, will give you these shares of stock. This is a closely held corporation. You can't have a world in which they have to immediately sell half to outsiders to pay the taxes. It doesn't make any sense at all. There has to be some details like what the option price is and so on. And when the plaintiffs come in and describe a transaction that is fantastical, one gets a little worried. Describe a transaction that's fantastical and don't make any effort to figure out how much of the company is debt. It's a serious problem.
Your Honor, again, I would say that contract law does not include a requirement that the deal be a good one.
We normally interpret contracts so as to be sane rather than insane.
Correct. Correct. However, if two parties make a deal, and they do it all the time, that ends up not being a very good deal for one side or the other.
You say they do it all the time. Your clients describe a deal that nobody makes in the real world, which, of course, is one reason to suspect that this wasn't the deal. And, of course, it turns out not to be in writing or anything like that. It's very convenient to describe a promise to do something fantastical that no one ever put in writing.
I understand the point you're making, but I think under well-established principles of contract law, there is sufficient here to avoid a summary judgment, even if the deal may not be as complex, because there is clear evidence from my clients with respect to what they understood the deal to be and that it was repeated many times. So with that, I'll reserve, I hope, a minute.
I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal. There's nothing to reserve, but I will let you have some rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Harrod.
May it please the court. Sole piece of evidence with respect to the plaintiff's claim of damages is a piece of testimony from Mr. McCormick. It, in and of itself, has several problems, which I've highlighted in our response brief, and the district court, I think, properly noted. It wasn't evidence of any fair market value of the corporation as a whole. It was more likely...
That completely puzzles me. Sentinel owns about 60% of Falcon as a whole. Let's suppose what the record shows is that in exchange for 60% of Falcon, Sentinel took $60 cash on the barrel head. What's an appropriate inference about the value of Falcon as a whole?
If it's an insider transaction between someone who was also an owner of the company, I don't know if there is a fair market inference
it's
you can
a transaction
make.
As it's described between two insiders. Now, the normal understanding of market transactions is that the current owner won't part for something for less than its value to him, and the guy who's buying it won't pay more than his value to him, and there may be consumer surplus. But if we know that one insider buys 60% from another insider, the normal understanding is that the total price is 100, because if it's anything other than that, one or the other of these participants is a fool. And there's no reason in this record to believe that either Khan or Sentinel is a fool. At least you're not arguing that.
I'm not arguing that.
Exactly. And it's the same with this financing business, right? Falcon couldn't pay Sentinel more than somebody would lend it in an LBO. But Sentinel, assuming it was not a fool, would not accept less than what it could get by continuing to hold the investments in Falcon. All right? So you've got the standard willing buyer, willing seller condition. And you can always go around and say that people are idiots or the price set by a willing buyer and a willing seller should be ignored, but that's not what we normally do in valuation. We've got a willing buyer, we've got a willing seller, we got a price.
Yes, we do, but there is no way to extrapolate that into a value for the corporation.
That's like saying, even when we've got a winning buyer and a winning seller, we can't put a real value on it because we don't know what the consumer surplus was. And that's never required in these transactions.
The plaintiffs in this case had full opportunity to conduct discovery as to...
Look, there isn't anything to the idea of an arm's-length transaction except when we got a price that a willing buyer and a willing seller actually take. Right? That's what the thing is worth, and that's what we've got. This is an actual transaction price. It's not anything made up.
In this case, we don't even know what it was that was specifically purchased. We know that 60% of the common shares were purchased, and all of the preferred shares were purchased. But there's no evidence as to how that parlays into the full value of the corporation. There simply is no evidence of, during the months of discovery, they never asked for evaluation. The plaintiffs never asked for financial statements. They never retained an expert. They never inquired into the current value of the corporation. They didn't even ask to determine how Sentinel's partial interest actually factored into the overall value of Falcon Holdings as a whole. They provided no figures of any kind, no basis for determining any figures, and they didn't even request the documentation necessary to make such a determination. The evidence is a single piece of testimony from one person testifying about a memorandum which is not even a part of the record on appeal here. Moreover, this partial subjective value was in 2005. The plaintiffs are seeking damages today. They haven't established any current objective value of any kind for Falcon as a whole. In essence, their determination is unverified. It's not fleshed out. There isn't enough here for a jury to make a determination or any trier of fact to make a determination.
I asked Ms. Ross this question, but do we know in this record how much Falcon borrowed in order to make this transaction?
No, we don't. Not in the record on appeal. Without any evidence necessary to look at the assets and liabilities of the corporation as a whole, putting aside the fact that Sentinel sold all of its preferred shares, which we don't know how it factors into the company as a whole, and 60% of its common shares, which at least is a bit more capable of being valued, there is no way to determine what the value of the corporation as a whole is today. I have nothing further.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Ross.
For allowing me just a moment of rebuttal. I only have two points to make. One is I do think that a willing buyer and willing seller argument should be sufficient to result in a reversal here. Secondly, even if you subtract 50% of the value and assume all of that was financed, there would still be value left using that $47 million purchase price. And that, again, seems to me to be sufficient to avoid summary judgment. The Illinois courts have been very clear that they don't require a discount for minority shareholders in the shareholder oppression context.
No, you may still not be understanding the nature of my question. I wasn't asking about minority discounts or block sales or anything like that. What's hanging me up is trying to figure out how much of this firm is debt and how much is equity.
And
your whole claim for your clients was 50% of equity.
Right, 50% of equity, and we have the overall price. And I guess what I would say is we also know in the record the amount of value of the preferred securities, and we know the amount of value of the common stock. So even if you assume that all of that money was borrowed, that would still leave you deducting that from the enterprise value with an amount that a jury could use to reach a verdict with respect to damages. And it seems to me that should be sufficient. And that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.